Thank you, Jonathan, and thank you very much too for that reading. I love to hear the Bible read well. You know, boys, that's it's a dying art in our community. I thought that was well read, Jonathan. I love to hear the Bible read well, read intelligently and read clearly. It's the thing I'd like to do. If I had my choice of ecclesial offices, I'd be a reader. I wouldn't be a speaker. I love reading the Bible publicly. I just love the way the Bible's written, and I think if you can understand it and convey that message, it's a wonderful gift to be able to read the Bible well, and we need to watch that. I think that our young brethren sometimes worry too much about getting all the names and titles right and not getting the... Not that I'm against that, by the way, but by all means read the divine name. But I think sometimes we concentrate on that so much and we forget the meaning of that chapter and get behind the sense of it. And that was well read. Well, boys, we've got to talk about your responsibility to your ecclesia. And let me say this at the outset, that I got something off my chest. It did me good. It got it off my chest. I really steamed up at the moment about a few things, and it doesn't matter. But one thing I want to say very sincerely is that I think that you in Melbourne are not suggesting others, of course, are exempt from this comment either, but I think in Melbourne at the moment you've got a wonderful group of kids here. I think you lads have got a good future to build on if you stick together and if you do what you're doing now, stick on the word and build your friendships and make certain there's a lot of loyalty among you based upon the word of truth. I really see a great glow of hope here that perhaps we can really build something and get something really going where we can stimulate our ecclesias and thrill our brethren and sisters with the truth. And we have a great responsibility to our ecclesia. Now tonight we want to make this completely informal. I want to give a talk. I want to talk to you as like a father would his son. I want just to be a nice relationship together. I want you to tell you about ecclesial life as I see it and where I think your responsibilities are and what you can best do for the ecclesia. Now, you know, here's a good suggestion to start with. It's what we did. I don't think we did this by, what can I say? I don't think we sat down with a great deal of wisdom, Auntie Verna and I, at the time, because we were too much in love, and, you know, we're a bit giddy and silly when you're in love like that. And I don't think we sat down with a great deal of wisdom and thought this through, you know, like Solomon. I think it just happened. But it worked. And that is this, that when we... I came into the truth in 1953, okay? I don't mind telling you how old I am. I was 22 when I came into the truth. Don't make a calculation. I was 22 when I came into the truth in 1953. In 1954, in 1953, I met this girl, Verna Wigzell. She sort of, you know, I married half the world when I married her, top of things. So many relations, it doesn't matter. I often used to say to brethren, you know, there's only two classes in the truth, there's in-laws and outlaws. And one brother said to me, he said, "Do you know the difference?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, outlaws are wanted." But anyway, I'm getting off the track. In 1954, that's 1 year after I come into the truth, we started a lecture effort in the northern districts of Adelaide. At that time, there were only the Adelaide Central Meeting, which numbered about 500 or 600 brothers and sisters. And there was the Cumberland meeting was going, which was west of Adelaide, and then it was south, and down in the west was Woodville. So there was Woodville and Cumberland, and then Enfield was next. So 1 year in the truth, and we are out in the northern suburbs giving lectures. And what we used to do in those days, and still do in Adelaide, is that if we want to start a new meeting, we first of all look for people who are enthusiastically wanting to do it. We don't say, "You better go and start an ecclesia." It's a bad way to start. We like to see young fellows come and say, "Brethren, we'd love to start a meeting. We think we can do something." Great. We'll work with that. But then what we would suggest is that you go out and you give lectures. You don't start your meeting immediately. You give, say, 3 months of lectures. That might involve, say, 10 to 12 lectures you'll give of a Sunday evening. Now, if you see in the course of that lecturing effort that you've got some interest, say you get quite a few people turning up, and that continues, then after, say, 3 or 4 months, you might then form an ecclesia, because you can see you've got a base for that. Follow me? Otherwise, if you go out and just tear out and start an ecclesia, and someone has a row or something, and things go wrong, and you all come crawling back home, it leaves a nasty taste in everybody's mouth. It's been a failure. You don't want that. So in 1954, we started that lecture effort. I was the doorman. of the... That was my job. I was the doorman. Right? I have still got the original book in my drawer as a memento of our opening, that in 1954, the Northern District's lecture effort, we used to hire halls in the various areas, and we used to have these lectures, and I was the doorman keeping the names of the people who attended. And there was a certain girl from Cumberland, Sister B. Wiggs, who was regular in attendance at that meeting. She was very interested in the truth, and she only came to support the lectures. But at any rate, that book's in my drawer still. And we had about, I suppose, a dozen to 15 brethren involved in that venture, most of whom were older brethren, which is unusual, really, for a new lecture effort like that. And I was one of the rare people there, a young fellow. And we found, Vernon and I found, a tremendous difficulty, because a lot really fell upon us to do the active work and do a lot of the administration, because the brethren we had were wonderful people. They were the finest people I'd ever worked with. But they were older, and they didn't find it as easy as we did. In 1955, we did something very wonderful. We got married. So we were married in 1955, 2 years after I come with the truth, and then we started to have our family. And that's how we grew up in the ecclesia. In 1956, the lecture effort became an ecclesia. So we were going for 2 years, nearly, before we became an ecclesia. Now, here's my advice. We are still with the Enfield ecclesia. Okay? You absorbing that? Now, my point is this. It isn't much good me standing here tonight and very intelligently, or trying to be intelligent, telling you how to behave yourself in the ecclesia if you're going to go from ecclesia to ecclesia to ecclesia to ecclesia to ecclesia to ecclesia. Isn't it the same?
No.
See, you know what I mean? How can you possibly be effective if you're not around the place, if you don't know the place? Now, I say that with tongue way out in the cheek, because I am now a perfect stranger to Enfield. My name's on the roll, but I ain't never there, right? But still, that's different, because now we're older and we've got a bigger meeting. But earlier, we could not afford not to be there. Follow me? We were at everything. I mean, everything. With all our children on the floor, because we only had a few members and we had to be there. Now, what that means is that if you stick with a meeting and you make it your baby. So my suggestion is, Sam, you're listening, right? You find a girl, right? A nice little girl, some silly little girl that'll marry you. Right? And then if you find an opportunity where there's an ecclesia in your area starting up, you start with it. You go with it right on day one. Get in there on ground level. Don't wait and say, I'll see how they go. Okay? Don't do that, because what will happen is you'll turn up about 3 or 4 months later to see how they go, and you're sort of getting on the bandwagon, and you're ever going to be out of joint with that meeting, because they're all going to think forever and a day that you came just when everything was settled down and you didn't shoulder the burden. Get in there and start it with your little wife, right? What's her name again? But anyway, you see what I mean? So when you get in there, what happens is this. Now, only Vern and I did that, so we feel that Enfield is our baby. It's our little baby. We feel really rooted and grounded in that meeting. To such an extent that until I became an itinerant preacher, until I became that, say a few years ago this happened now, and I don't go there very often at the moment, but when I did, I could almost feel people's hearts beating in that meeting. I could almost walk in that meeting and say, hey, there's something wrong here. I could feel it in my fingertips. Because you just feel the atmosphere. You knew people, you knew how they thought. Now, you're in a position then to assess situations and be able to say, hey, we need to put a bit of emphasis on this side of the truth or on that side of the truth. This meeting's drifting this way, so let's put a bit of emphasis here and keep trying to keep that meeting on even keel. Now, you can't do that if you're forever on the move, can you? So strong advice is that as a young fellow, if Christ does not come, and I can't see this happening, it's almost useless me saying this, but anyway, I will say it, if the Lord delays in length of time, and you happen to get married, and you happen to have the opportunity to start with a meeting, you do that. And you determine with your little wife that this is going to be your meeting, and come anything. Whatever circumstances in life, you are going to pitch in there and you're going to try and make that ecclesia a good place to live in. Okay? And you're not going to get disgruntled after the first couple of weeks and move on to another ecclesia because you can't get on with this person, or because this problem's too big, or because they think this. If a thing is wrong, put it right. Get in there and pitch, and don't criticize. Now that's a very strong piece of advice, because after a while, a few years will go by and you will feel a belonging to that meeting. You will actually feel that this is your family. Not in theory, it'll be true. Because you'll get to know people, and you'll get to love them, and you'll get to work with them, and you'll get to understand them. And then you can be an effective member in that meeting. Do you follow me? Follow me? Now the other thing is this, and this is what you've always got to think about. Sooner or later, Sam, there'll be little Sams in the world. Oh, spare us. But it'll happen, you see. Oh, you're right. What a thought. I mean, talk about a clinical problem. Anyway, the thing is, it'll happen. Now, what are you going to do about that? You're going to say, well, I've got this little codger, you see, and they're growing up around your legs. Now, you see, Auntie Vern and I would sit down, and we would talk about life, and we would think, now, what are we going to do? You see, we've got this family coming on. Now, one thing we made, a determination. We said this, that ecclesia is going to be a haven for my kids. Okay, now my children, I'm not going to bring them up in the truth entirely on my own. I'm going to try, and Auntie Verna will do her bit. But you have to understand, and we've got to be honest and sincere about this, you've got to be honest and admit that your ecclesia does a heck of a lot for your children. Pam, is that right? Andrew, you agree with that, or don't you? Right? You know, don't you, that you can tell these little brats of yours what they should do in your house, but you know that if they don't get a good example of that meeting, then you're battling. Now you know that, don't you? So you know full well that your ecclesia is valuable to your children. What idiot would pull his ecclesia down with a family around his legs? What idiot would not pitch in and build an ecclesia to be a strong ecclesia with his family around him? Hey? Now let me give an example of that in a practical sense in the Bible. Turn to Nehemiah chapter 4. Now this is a good reason why we should behave ourselves properly in the ecclesia, because it's our children's future. Now look at this. They're building a wall. In Nehemiah chapter 4. And look at verses 13 and 14. Or take verse 12. Or verse 11. Start at verse 11. Our adversary said, they shall not know, neither shall they see, till we come in the midst and among them and slay them and cause the work to cease. In other words, they said, hey, we'll creep in behind the wall, and before they ever know where we are, we'll have their throats cut. This is what the Sanballats and the Tobiah and the Ammonite and Geshem the Arabian and all their crowd, all the worldly people were saying, we'll sneak into this place and we'll destroy it, right? Verse 12, and it came to pass that when the Jews which dwelt by them came, they said unto us 10 times, from all places whence ye shall return unto us, they will be upon us. Now let me translate that. So the crowd were coming into work in Jerusalem, and the wall's not built, and there's gaps everywhere, and they're coming in and saying, hey, you want to see what's going on out here? The world's coming. I tell you, we've got no hope at all. Look, from 10 directions, they're going to be on it. We're finished, brethren. Oh, it's terrible. Nehemiah had a solution to that. Here's his solution. Verse 13. Therefore set I in the lower places, the lower place, where the wall was the lowest, behind the wall, and on the higher places, I even set the people after their families, with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked and rose up and said unto the nobles and to the rulers and to the rest of the people, be ye not afraid of them, remember the Lord, which is great and terrible, and fight for your brethren, your sons and your daughters, your wives and your houses. So here's Nehemiah's solution. I'm a brother that's coming into work, and I've got a few kids, and I'm coming in, oh, you want to hear Geshem the Arabian? They're saying, we're going to come and slit our throat. We won't even know. We won't even know they're here. and they're going to be, and they come from every direction. And Nehemiah, look at all these holes in the wall. What are we going to do? And Nehemiah suggests to me, how many children you got, John? 7 children. That's why I've got a perfect family, see, 7. And we'll bring them into Jerusalem. Yeah, but there's a hole in the wall. Plug it. You plug the wall. And I think to myself, I see Geshem the Arabian at him, sharpening his knife with his big leering grin, his beard. And I see the other chaps out with a spear, and they're looking at my kids. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to plug that wall as hard as I can go. And Nehemiah's policy was, put people with their families where there is holes in the wall. Now the lesson of that is that in your ecclesia, when you have ecclesial problems arising and you can see that if this is not a handled problem, your ecclesia is going to become fractious, it's going to become difficult to live there, it's going to be a bad influence, and you're looking at your kids and saying, hey, my kids are going to go to Sunday school there, they're going to go to the meetings there, they're going to go to young folks there, I'd better get in there and plug the gap. No good saying I'll go elsewhere, because we'll find the same problems. Thing is, get in and solve that problem, not because only for the ecclesia's sake, but for your children's sake. Now, you know, there's a tremendous wisdom in that. So you see, I've always maintained that if we look after God's family, he will look after our family. Now, I'm a bit of a radical about this. I differ from a lot of people. I've got called over the coals for saying this. I'm going to say it again. People say, first your family, and then your ecclesia. I reverse that. I say, first the ecclesia, and then your family. Because, you see, if you're not prepared to get in there and look after God's children, you can scarcely get on your bended knees and ask him to look after yours. And furthermore, the more you do for God's family and building God's family is where your children are going to spend almost as much time as they spend in your house. And you're doing a double service by looking after your ecclesia, both for God and his children and for your own family. It's a very great and very wise thing to think that through. So then your life then becomes dedicated for the right reasons. You have the right reasons for doing what you're doing. It's very wise. Now I want you to turn to Psalm 147. And a very similar thing here that you read in Nehemiah. Now if you want to stop me any time and make any comment or question, you do it. We don't want to be having any standing ceremony tonight. We want to try and have a discussion together about ecclesial life. Now I'm going to show you 3 verses in this psalm. They're interspersed through the psalm. You just look what they say. Psalm 147, verse 2. Yahweh doth build up Jerusalem. He gathereth together the outcasts of Israel. Verse 13. For he hath strengthened the bars of thy gates. He hath blessed thy children within thee. And then verse 19. He showeth his word unto Jacob, his statutes and his judgment unto Israel. Now you work that out. Interspersed through that psalm is this theme. So what Yahweh does is he builds Jerusalem, and it's got gates, and the gates are open. And he looks around for his children. Here they come, and he gets his children, the outcasts of Israel. Come here, quick, need kids, quick. And he puts them in the city of Jerusalem, and he goes from the gates, and he goes, slam, and the gates slam. They're all locked in Jerusalem, safe. So he's got them in there and he's locked the gates. Now they're safe. And he gets out and he says, now let's learn about the Bible. He showeth his word unto Jacob. He hadn't done that with any other nation. Isn't that ecclesial life? What do? You encourage your children to be separate from the world. You get them involved in your ecclesia, heavily involved in that. And when you get them inside there and involved, you get them to learn about the Bible. But what if your ecclesia is as bad as the world? What if your ecclesia is not running like that? What are you going to do then? You're in big trouble. You've got to keep them home, perhaps, and spend more time with them at home, and then you're going to find that they're going to become dissatisfied. Because there's very rarely you're going to get a family of any size, whatever, that's going to be happy with just mum and dad. Let's face it. I mean, we're all fuddy-duddy sometimes, the youngsters, and they've got to have their own peer group. They've got to have their own help. Best to have it in the ecclesia. Now, that's what that says, right? So my strong advice, lads, is stick with your meeting, work in that meeting, be genuine about it, and always think to yourself, it's really for your benefit that you're doing what you're doing, as well as everybody else's, because you're going to live there. And that ecclesia is going to influence you. If you can influence it, it will in turn reciprocate and influence you for good. Now, that has ever been our policy, Arnie Werner and mine, and to a degree it's worked. We made a lot of mistakes, we regret that, but we did our best, and it's been a very valuable thing to us. Very valuable thing. Now, we read 1 Timothy 3, okay? Now, here's ecclesial life. Here's the Apostle Paul writing to a young man. So it's very relevant, isn't it? Very relevant. In verse 14 of 1 Timothy 3, he says, "These things, Timothy, write I unto thee, hoping to come unto thee shortly. But if I tarry long, thou mightest know how thou oughtest to behave thyself in the house of God." Now, young fellas, he didn't say how you ought to behave yourself, full stop. He said how you behave yourself in the house of God. Now, I maintain that if when you balance out the scriptural teachings, especially the apostle, you cannot justify the attitude which says, I can live the truth as good in my home as I can live in the ecclesia, because you just cannot do it. It is impossible. I mean, impossible. Now, I know there are people in isolation. I understand that. I know there are exceptions, but God knows those exceptions. But where there are no exceptions, the truth happens to include the ecclesia. It happens to be part of the truth. In other words, what God is saying to what Paul is saying to Timothy, there's a certain behavior, Timothy, that's necessary in the house of God. He can't exercise that in isolation. It's got to be exercised in conjunction with others. It's much like we say, you know, say I'm going back a few years now, a little bit later than Sam, when he's got about 8 or 9 kids, and I'm a bit further, and I've got these little toddlers, you know, and we say that, you know, the Taylors have asked us over to Melbourne, and Auntie Pauline and Uncle Roy, and, you know, we say, when we get the Taylors, be careful, behave yourself. Whoa, the Taylors are real, you know, whoa, they're very special people. And you say, this is how you've got to behave yourself with the Taylors. You know, you say, don't with the kids to disgrace you. Well, Paul says, you're going into God's house. That's the ecclesia. It's God's house. Incredible. Okay? So this is what this chapter's about. Now, he says this house is the ecclesia of the living God. Right? Now, we take out the word the. Not in the Greek. Now you say, what difference does that make? You say it. Ecclesia of living God. What's that telling you? Can you see the difference, Ben? Can you see the difference? You got the ecclesia of the living God? No, it's the ecclesia of living God. What's the difference? Exactly. Okay. Isn't that a good answer? Hey? You're going to have a mighty ecclesia with Ben in it. Probably be on his own. But anyway, the thing is, that's right. Good answer. Great is the mystery of God manifestation. Okay, that's the first point. Okay. Now, the living God. Now, tell me, what's that? Who is that chapter talking? What sort of people is that chapter talking about? Who are they?
Servants.
Pardon?
Servants. Living
people. Who said that? Living people. They're actually living. Do you know something? Sometimes you've got to line up a person with a lamppost like that to see if they're actually moving. Don't you? You think, is he moving? Or isn't he? And they're not moving.
These people are alive. Bishops and deacons, their wives and their children. And they're actually moving. Gee, they're on the move. You know, because God is alive in them. That's the whole point he's making, isn't it? Now you say, oh, see, that's the whole point. That's the whole chapter. He's not talking about just the rank and file who occupy a chair. These people are actually alive. So they are ecclesia of living God. They're moving. Now this is the deacons and their wives, the bishop and their wives and their children. Now who are the bishops and the deacons? Well, you take the two words, and you know something? It's absolutely a complete summary of ecclesial life. The word bishop comes from a word meaning an overseer. Someone who has the oversight of the administration of the ecclesia. Today we'd call him the recording brother, or maybe one of the arranging brethren, or in America he might be on the board or something. But that's who he is. He would be an administrator in the ecclesia. The word deacon is a Greek word which means to run errands, to go on a message. And it's the title which denotes those people who are now have to do the practical tasks of the meeting. So the bishop or the overseer decides that the ecclesial hall should be painted and it should be green. So the deacon gets in his car and goes and gets the green paint and puts it on. So there's your bishops and your deacons. Now we haven't got spirit-gifted brethren today. We haven't got the Spirit saying you're a bishop and you're a deacon. We haven't got that. But we have the Spirit of the Spirit gifts, in the sense that we've all got differing abilities, haven't we? So some of us are good at administration and some of us are good at practical duties. I wouldn't want Jono tiling my bathroom. But I'd go to him about some technical matter, wouldn't I? He knows. You follow me? So we've all got different abilities. So our abilities, therefore, categorise us. We fall into categories, not because God says you're this and you're that, but because we just happen to have the ability in that direction. Is that right? So we can either be a bishop or a deacon. But whatever we are actually moving. Isn't that interesting? So what do? You get involved in ecclesial work where you fit. Now this is how to behave yourself in the ecclesia. So you want to be an active member. Now boys, we all have ambitions, okay? Now Paul says there's nothing wrong with that. He says, look, if a man desire the office of a bishop, it's a good work. There is nothing wrong with ambition if the word ambition is understood in its right context. That is, a will and a desire to serve God. That's ambitious. Not ambitious with the point of view of wanting to be smart or a boss or clever, but someone who really wants to serve God. Now, Paul says there's nothing wrong, therefore, with being ambitious. But you can be ambitious to the point of being very wrong. You understand what I mean, don't you? You can be ambitious for the wrong reason. So, I say this. In ecclesial life, young brethren like you need a nice big long mirror in your bedroom. And you need to stand in front of the mirror and look at yourself. Some people would find that very difficult. But you stand there and you look solidly. Now I'm being silly, aren't I? But I'm trying to make my point. You look in that mirror and you're honest, absolutely honest with yourself. And you say to yourself, I can do that, but I can't do that. Now, you're not going to find that out in 5 minutes. In ecclesial life, you're going to get involved. You want to be involved somewhere. You start probably at young folks, right? You start at young folks level, get involved in the committee. And I'll tell you something, if you have elections for young folks committee, some ecclesias do, and you don't get voted on, always remember this, you don't need a badge to serve Christ. You don't have to have a little badge that says committee. You don't need that. So if you don't get voted on, still go along at any rate and work. Okay? Because you know the definition of a committee. It's a bunch of incompetents appointed by the unwilling to do the unnecessary. So you don't have to have a badge which says committee. You can still go along despite the vote and say, can I help? Okay. Follow me?
Now, when you do that, you're going to find that you're very adept at doing some things and not at doing others. And what else are you going to find is that the things you're adept at doing, the thing you can do, you may not want to do. And the things you can't do, you try, to everybody's annoyance. Okay? You ever had that happen in ecclesial life? No, you're too young. But I have. You ask Aunty Verna. We've had been this through and through again. Now, you know the spirit gifts, don't you? You know how that the spirit gifts, there were, how many spirit gifts there actually were? There were nine of them. Nine. There were nine different gifts. Let's have a look at them in 1 Corinthians 12, okay? Now, this will all help you with ecclesial life. Don't think because we haven't got the manifestation of the spirit gifts that we can't take lessons from them. We can. Now, here they all are in 1 Corinthians 12. Now, let's look at verse 7. But the manifestation of the Spirit is given to every man to profit with all. In the Greek, that would read something like this. But the distribution of the Spirit is given to each person that everybody might profit. So individual gifts or abilities has got to be used to everybody's profit, not yours. Yours, yes, true, but not only yours, everybody's profit. So God says to one, verse 8, spirit of wisdom, knowledge, faith, gifts of healing, working of miracles, prophecy, discerning of spirits, divers kinds of tongues, interpretations of tongues. Look at them all. Absolutely different. And then he says, now let me illustrate what I mean. And he takes a human body. Here I am. Human body. I'm like one of these ads in a health magazine, you know. In 6 months you can have a body like mine. But you see, here I am. Now look at me. Have a look at me. I've got two hands. How about that? 2 feet. I've got half a mouth of teeth and 4 ears. I've got two. But I'm a body, aren't I? Now look at it. Now you take each thing separately. That hand looks nothing. Well, looks something like that here, but it hasn't got fingers, has it? Like, you know what I mean? I can't kick a football with my ear, but I can with my leg. So you see, here I am a body, but then you put all that body together, it's absolutely different. But when you stick my arms here where they ought to go, and your legs here, and put my eyes in their sockets, and the ears in the right place, it all works together. I'm working. I can hear, I can speak, and I've got everything together. I want to point something, my hand goes, oh, my hand's open that. And then it reaches out, and then my feet walk over and take that over there. So I'm all working, I'm coordinated, and yet everything's different about me. All the hands and the feet are completely different. Now you look at verse 18. Look at this. But now hath God set the members, every one of them in the body, as it hath pleased him. Now, Paul's talking about the ecclesial body, but he's never losing sight of his analogy with the human body. So let's have a look. I'm being ridiculous, I know that, but I want to be ridiculous to make the point. So when God made the body, you know what he did? He decided, in his wisdom, to put my tongue in my mouth. And there are brethren who want to speak from the platform out of the back of their neck. You know what I mean? Somebody is ambitious to be a speaker, and he's hopeless. Absolutely hopeless. And he could be talking at the back of his neck, but God put the tongue there. He didn't put it here. And there's another brother, he wants to do everything around the meeting. He wants to fix everything. And he's the greatest, clumsiest thing you've ever seen in your life. Smashes all the windows, and he's got the locks upside down on the doors, and he's absolutely hopeless, but he insists upon fixing it. So when you go to the toilet, the door won't lock. You see what I mean? He's annoyance to everybody. And because, you see, he forgot that God put the hands on the end of the arms. He didn't put the hands in the hips. You can laugh, but see, God hath set the members in the body as it hath pleased him. So what you do, you look in that mirror in your room and you say, now I've been in the truth for 3 or 4 years, I've been a member of this ecclesia, and I've tried this and I've tried that and I've tried that, and being absolutely honest, you say, I really don't think I'll ever make a speaker, but I seem to get on well in that committee work, and I really did enjoy that, and I found out that people really appreciated what I did, and I really didn't want to be that sort of person, but there you are, that's what I am. I am what I am by the grace of God. So you go along and you put yourself in the body exactly where you fit. Now, if everybody did every ecclesia, the ecclesia would be walking around like a perfectly balanced, coordinated human being, very adept at both practical and administrative duties. Isn't that true? Now, you can't go beyond that analogy. Now, let me tell you how you can tell lies. You see, there are two ways you can tell a lie when looking in that mirror. You can convince yourself that you are a wonderful speaker, because to you it's very plain what you're saying. What you haven't realised is that no one else understands you. You haven't got a clue what you're talking about. But you got it in your head, and you really understand it. And I've listened to brethren, I think, well, there's one thing for sure, that chap, he really understands what he's saying, but nobody else does. So he knows what he knows his stuff. He just has not got being God-given ability to give that talk. So he lies to himself, and because he thinks he knows, and he does, and he understands it, and when he's speaking, he's convincing himself. He thinks everybody else is convinced. He hasn't looked up and saw people going, oh, oh, until he realised, and he's telling lies, and he's saying, I can do that, and he can't. Now, the other lie you can tell is this. You go to a young fella and say, listen, Jono, we want you to do we want you to organise this young folks out. Oh, I couldn't do that, I'm no good at that, I couldn't. And you go home and you convince yourself in that mirror that you can't do that, but you can. You're a liar. You've lied to yourself, see, and you get out of it because you say you can't do it. Hey, you see what I mean? And so you can tell lies. You can tell lies because you're ambitious to do something that you're not cut out for, and you can tell lies when you say you can't do something that you can. What you've got to be is scrupulously honest. And when you find out by experience where you fit in that ecclesia, then get in there where you fit and put yourself on the body where God intended the arm or the leg or the tongue or the eye, whatever it is, where it intended to be. And when you do that, then you will work in a coordinated fashion and you will do valuable work. Now let me tell you about a brother in our meeting. I think it was you, Jim, that made the point about older brethren being thrilled. It was you that said that. I have to confess that's true again. I like agreeing with Jim. He's a nice chap. But the thing is this. He said that, and it's true. I am very thrilled as an older person. Actually, I'll be very honest with you. I'm very thrilled with coming to Melbourne. I really am. I think you lads have got a terrific thing going. I love it here because you respond. I love that. I love anybody who responds to the truth. All right. Now, this brother in our meeting, he was an older brother, but you wouldn't know what this did for me. That brother could not put two words together in our meeting. If you spoke to him, he'd look down the ground and he'd always cracking jokes. He drove people mad with his jokes. All it was a complex. He couldn't conduct a normal conversation. So he'd come up with stupid jokes all the time. You go, ha ha ha. You know, so but he just couldn't do it. And people got annoyed with him because I never did, because I knew the poor fellow. He just didn't know how to conduct. But I'll tell you something. I knew that every time I went out that back room to get ready to give a talk, he'd be there putting the hymns in the hymn board every day. And he would be the only one that would do it for the memorial meeting, for the lecture, for the study classes, for the fraternals, everything. That was the brother. And he'd be there slotting the numbers in the hymn board and hanging the hymn board up. And he became an institution. It's all he could do. But he didn't look for any plaudits, he never spoke about it, but he just kept putting that board up there. And I suppose a lot of people in that meeting never took a scrap of notice, but I knew that brother was doing that because he had such a complex and such timidity about him. He just couldn't face or talk to people. He found something he could do, and he did that for as long as I can remember. 4 years until he died. Now, we found that he happened to be probably a toenail. But you know what he did? He went and put himself on the end of his toe. And he didn't matter what anybody thought, that's what he could do, and he did that consistently for years. Now, you don't know what that did for me. I'd go out there, and I'd get out the back hall, and I'd look sideways at that brother, and I'd think, wow. If I did as consistently my job as he did his, and religiously as he did that, I'd be satisfied. And it always used to warm my heart to see him there doing that. Now, that's just an illustration of what I mean is slotting in. Now, let me tell you what happens if you don't slot in, or even if you do. This is what's going to happen in ecclesial life. 1 Corinthians 12 again, right? Now, there are going to be a couple of problems that rise. And young brethren, of course, especially, we're talking especially to young brethren. We don't exclude other people, but we are here at the School of the Prophets. It's a very special thing. So we're talking to young fellas. You're going to have a problem with your pride. It's inevitable. Everybody's proud. And especially if you're any good at anything, people are going to dust your coat, you see. Marvellous, going to pat you on the back. And you think, oh, I'm pretty good. Pretty powerful for me. Boy, if I wooed them, laid them in the aisles. I'm a great. You really think you're something, and you do. You just run away with yourself if you're any good at something, and it's almost inevitable. It'll happen, but you see, you've got to temper that. You've got to get over that. You've got to sort of try and get over that. And you know, there's one way around that, and that is, I always, at times, try and go over my faults. I never get through them all, actually, but I give it a go, and I always remember my faults. Because, you know, I get a lot of praise for this, and it doesn't do me a lot of good. And I sit down and I then think about all the awful things I've done, and that levels me out a bit. I suppose it's a mad way to do it, but it works. And it helps me, see? But anyway, you're going to get this problem. Now, Paul deals with this in 1 Corinthians 12 in a most wonderful way. Now, you look what he says. There are two problems, and they both stem from pride. That's a nice name for the other one. They don't call it pride. There's a name for it. What's that when a person is very self-effacing? They say he's... what's the word I'm thinking here? Oh, strike. Oh, anyway, it's a sort of pseudo-humility, you see. He never can do anything right. But anyway, in 1 Corinthians 12, let's read verse 14. For the body is not one member, but many. Now, you listen carefully. If the foot shall say, because I am not the hand, I'm not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? So I'm Brother Foot, and Luke here is Brother Hand. Now here's my foot, and there's Luke's hand. What do you notice about those two members? Pardon? Are they? They're similar. They're members of action. I do things with my hand, I walk with my foot. But I would dare to say, thinking about it, that I'd rather perhaps lose my foot than my hand. So Luke and I are similar brethren. We've got similar capabilities. We make out to be friends. And he's probably very friendly with me. But I'm Brother Foot and he's Brother Hand. And when it comes to a choice in the ecclesia, we similar brethren, if he's available, they're going to pick him. And I'm going to say, I'm not of the body. No one wants me. <Come on. laughs> And when he's not looking, I'm going to go, oh, because we're similar. So I get peeved, not of the body. You know the attitude? That's one problem. You think it's funny. You watch. Put it up here, look. I got a transparency. This proves the point. See? You're members of the body, and members in particular, says Paul, in particular. Members with similar abilities are liable to demonstrate envy.
I am not of the body. Now, the brother ear, yeah, let's read it again. Let's take another couple of members, right? Verse 16, and if the ear shall say, because I'm not the eye, I'm not of the body. Now, what do you know about the ear and the eye? They're two organs of sense. They're similar. What would you rather be without? An ear or an eye? Absolutely. So brother ear says, no one wants me. Brother eye. Let him have brother eye. Because he's similar. It breeds envy. Isn't that marvellously done? Hey? You reckon that's good? Isn't that marvellously done? Because that is exactly what's happened with brethren who are similar. So you ought to be careful. You're going to have a job in the meeting. You're going to be fitted to a job, but there may be somebody who's got a similar job and a bit better than you. Doesn't matter. God has given him that. You support that brother and you do your best. And I'll tell you what's good about being brother foot or brother ear. Less responsibility. See, brother hand. See, now that's one good thing about it. You can fob it off. Brother, you fix it. You see the point? And that's a way around it. Don't do that. But it's very, you have at least got less responsibility. Now, what happens with these members? Let's come down to verse 21. Or verse 20, but now are there many members, yet one body. Now listen to this. And the eye cannot say to the hand. Now, we've got brother eye and brother hand. Now, what do you know about the eye and the hand? Pardon? They're dissimilar. Who's superior?
The eye.
The eye. I can do without a hand. From the eye, brother eye. So what's brother eye say? What's he say? He doesn't say I'm not of the body. He says, I've got no need of you, brother. You can get lost. See the point? Can you see the point? So you've got brethren with clearly superior abilities. Isn't this beautiful? Isn't it magnificent the way Paul does this? Look. Members with superior abilities are liable to treat each other with contempt. So brother eye says to brother hand, I've got no need of you. And brother ear says to brother foot, I've got no need of you. Look at the way they're coupled. Who ever saw that in 1 Corinthians before? Yeah? Did you then? Okay, but you forgot about it? Or you remembered it? Now that is extremely important. We never treat anyone with contempt. Okay? You never treat anyone with contempt, even though it may be true that in the ecclesia, you know, and it's no good being falsely humble, let's be honest, you know that you have valuable abilities. You recognize that as a fact, not as pride, as a fact. Now, it's no good sitting across the table and saying to the other chap, I really feel sorry for you, brother. You know, you must feel awful sometimes being such an idiot. Now, I'll tell you what I used to do, right? Now, what people used to wonder why I used to do this. I'm not putting myself up as a criterion of right, but I am telling you this. We were wise enough to see this. So as a young man, I was developing in the ecclesia at Enfield. I had all these older brethren with me. Finer brethren you would never find on God's earth. Nearly all of them are in their sleep now. They've gone to their sleep. I couldn't tell you what I think of them. That they were the salt of the earth, immovable in the truth. But they were simple chaps, you know. They didn't know very much. And we sat around the AB table. These are earlier days. It doesn't happen now. Long since this is gone. I go back 25, 30 years now. But we'd sit around the AB table, and I knew that if I had an idea about what things we'd done, that's what would happen. I knew that. And sometimes I'd come home from work, and only Bernard will tell you the truth of this, and I'd think about something we'd had to do in the meeting. And I'd realise that we hadn't got time to have an AB meeting to do that. And I didn't have time to get those chaps together and ask their opinion. I knew full well. Now, I'm telling you the absolute truth.
I knew full well I didn't have to ask their opinion. I knew that if I said to those chaps, look fellas, that'll be fine, John, we'll support that. I knew that. But I'd say to Arnie Verner, I'd ring up and I'd say, I'll be late tonight, dear. And I'd get in my car and I'd drive 2 or 3 miles that way, knock on the brother's door and tell him, oh, yeah, she'd be right, mate, she'd be right. Okay, Charlie, yeah. I'd drive another 3 or 4 miles. Yeah, that'll be fine, mate, good on you. You know, yeah, that's great, mate, yeah, good on you. And I'd drive another 3 or 4 miles. Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, that's a beaut idea. I didn't have to do that. But I didn't treat them with contempt. And I never lost their support, ever. In every crisis in the ecclesia, I never, ever lost their support. And no one could ever say that I went down behind their back and told them later, because I didn't. And people used to say to me, that was a silly thing to do, was that? I said, no, it's not. They said, but you know what they're going to do. I said, I know that. It's not the point. I went and spoke, because they were voted on by the ecclesia. The ecclesia put their confidence in them. I had confidence in them. I didn't value their opinions because they didn't have an opinion on those things that I was talking about, and it didn't matter. But I valued their support. I admired them as brethren, and I didn't treat them with contempt. Now, that is a very, very valuable lesson to learn in ecclesial life. So what have we learnt so far? That Sam's got to get married. And he's got to have a family. He's got that same made notes that I have yet, like, you mark that in your Bible. And that when he gets married, he's gonna become a member of some venture that's new, if it happens that way, and he's gonna pitch in with all the rest of you boys who are wherever you are, and you're gonna become valuable members of an ecclesia that you're gonna grow up in and make it your project in life. And when you do that, don't come to me. And then now, say Sam became a member of the or the devil's ecclesia or something, but whatever it was. Now imagine Sam becoming a member of this Diabolos ecclesia, and he's a foundation member. Now if I'm still here in about 20 years time with a walking stick saying, hey, yes, Sam, you know, if I'm like that, it's no good Sam coming to me and saying, Uncle John, the trouble with my ecclesia is this and this and this, because I'm going to say, yeah, but Sam, you are that ecclesia. And I'm going to say to him, don't talk to me about your ecclesia like that, because that's your ecclesia, that's you. I don't want to hear it from you, because I want to hear it from someone outside your ecclesia if it's necessary. I don't want to hear it from you, because if you say that is your ecclesia. No. Now what did Daniel the prophet do in his ecclesia when they went wrong? What did he do?
Right.
And what did he say?
We
have sinned. We have sinned. Daniel said that. We've sinned. Now you say, he didn't he? In other words, Daniel was telling God, not really me, you know, but I'll say it is, and I humble. You think God would be fooled by that? You think Almighty God is going to be fooled by you saying, we have sinned, when you don't really believe it? He's reading you right through like a pane of glass. Because Daniel, you could see that everybody has a share in the responsibility of the failure of anything with which they are attached. It was only the Lord Jesus Christ who could go to his Father and say this, all that you have given me, I've lost nothing. No one else could ever say that. Alright, you say Judas was lost. You say other people would lie. Yes. But Jesus knew who were his and who weren't. We don't know that. He did. And all that the Father had given him, he's the only man on earth that could say that. None of us can say that. And when our ecclesia goes wrong, we have sinned. Now let's never forget that. And if we adopt that attitude, then we've got an attitude that's going to work. Because we're going to make certain that our ecclesia tries to do the right thing at least. Because if it doesn't, then we'd fail somewhere. Now you might say, well, I haven't contributed to the failure. But what about, you can think back, maybe if, say, 10 years ago I'd have done this, or if I'd have said that, maybe if I'd have discerned this drift, maybe if I'd have been more awake, maybe if I'd been more caring, perhaps if I'd visited brethren and sisters and found out what they were thinking, and still now it's too late, maybe it wouldn't have happened. So you might go back 10 years to find that you were to blame. because you weren't watching, you weren't diligent, didn't keep your eyes open, and you didn't care. Now that's the thing you've got to watch out about. It's caring. It's caring. And you see, that's the thing, isn't it? It's caring. Now, this is what we got. This is what we do in the ecclesia. No, we got to do these things. Now, Paul had advice for Timothy. 1 Timothy 4:12. Okay. Now look at the list he gets here. Now, a young brother. Now, we've got a problem. We're going to have a problem in the Enfield Ecclesia. Only one. We only have one problem. No more problems in our meeting. We're different, you people. But that's not true. But the major problem we have, and I would say this, that I dare to say, I'll probably be careful what I say, but let's put it this way: there would be a huge percentage of our arranging brethren's meetings would be spent speaking about this one problem, and that is, how do you develop your young men in the ecclesia without lowering the standard of your platform work? That would be the single biggest problem we've got. We would spend literally hundreds of hours on that problem. We make a policy one week and change it the next. It only just got changed before I come away again, because we can't find a solution to that problem, because we are well served with speaking brethren. And we've got a lot of young fellas, young marrieds I'm talking about now, not necessarily your age, but people in their 30, say, between 20, 30, 25, 30, 40 age group. We've got stacked with those young fellas who do nothing. Because we've got such a choice on our platform. We have visiting speakers besides our own. And you can imagine who we got in Adelaide, which we're compact together. So we got Ronnie Cowie, we got Carl Parry, we got Johnny Knowles, we got Jimmy Luke, we got Peter Weller, and go on and on and on, besides our own speakers, and our young brethren are sitting there twiddling their thumbs. Now our problem is, what do we do? So in the end they go to another ecclesia, because there's nothing to do there. So we realise, as we're getting older, that if we don't do something about this, we're going to lose our young fellows, so we've got to give them a go. And we give them a go, nobody comes to Bible class. So you've got a problem. So how do you solve that problem? Well, there was a man in the Bible that had a policy to give everybody a go. Anybody know who he was? Pardon? Yeah. You know what happened? Yeah, but what happened with ecclesia when it came to the speaking brethren? It says specifically in the word what happened. Pardon? And what happened? What was the result of that? What happened? You know what Chronicles said? All the people fled down to Judah because they had the Levites teaching the truth. So the brother says to me, "No, I tell you, people don't come to our Bible class." "Oh, don't they?" "No, terrible attendance. You know, it's so many members in the ecclesia, and such a low percentage to attend a Bible class." And you know, "Oh yeah, well, hey, what's the problem?" "I don't know, it's just a lack of loyalty, you know, people are just not interested in the word." And then the next thing he starts telling you about how, "Oh, we've got a policy in our ecclesia. No, we feel that every brother should have his turn on the platform." I said, "Don't tell me any more about your Bob class." I learned that from Jeroboam. Now look, I'll tell you what, when Rehoboam and Jeroboam split the kingdom, there was in the army of Rehoboam 400,000, and there was in the army of Jeroboam 600,000. Within 50 years, as a result of Jeroboam's policy, when Jehoshaphat was on the kingdom, on the throne in Judah, and Ahab was on the throne in Israel, they got together to fight a common enemy. Jehoshaphat put in the field 1.25 million people, and Ahab put in the field 10,000. In 50 years. And the record says that they fled to Judah because the Levites, the teaching priests, were there. So, the answer, what's the solution to your problem? The solution is, yes, we've got to give young men a chance to develop on our platform, but they've got to deliver the goods. They've got to deliver the goods. You have to be good. Now, how are you going to find that out? Well, you say, how do you know whether if you don't hear them? Here's how you find it out. Let's read with me. You listen. "Let no man despise thy youth,
But be thou an example of the believers in word, in conversation, in love, in spirit, in faith, in purity. Till I come, give attendance to reading, to exhortation, to doctrine. Neglect not the gift that is in thee, which was given thee by prophecy, with the laying on of the hands of the presbytery, or that is the eldership. Meditate upon these things. Give thyself wholly to them, that thy profiting may appear to all. Got that? That thy profiting may appear to all. How does it appear? Meditate upon these things. Give yourself wholly to them. Take heed unto yourself and to the doctrine, and so on, that your profiting may appear to all. So there's two young men in their meeting. These are fictitious young men. Got a very ambitious young man. Comes along to the AB meeting. Listen, this ecclesia is not fair. I've got a complaint. What's your problem, young fella? We never get a go on the platform. Oh, you got these speakers, and every week they're on, and they have all their speaking, and us young fellas, we sit there and we do nothing. Right? We need to be given the chance and to show what we can do. So, okay, well, we'll give you a go. So he put up, he gets up there, and sits down. He thinks wonderful. There's another young fella, he's wandering around the meeting. You don't say nothing like that. And I'm looking out the corner of my eye. Don't think I don't. People think I don't notice what goes on. Don't you believe that? I can see sideways. And I watch this young fella, and he comes in the meeting, and he doesn't come to the AB meeting. He's not talking about getting on the platform. And he'll say to the fella, hey, come here, fellas. And there'll be about three or four guys, and you'll see him. And the fellas go, and I'm thinking to myself, you're next. Because his profiting has appeared to all. Now, he might get up there and he might drop his H's. He might say, get this or something. Or he might speak even pidgin English. But I tell you what, if he loves that Bible and he understands that if you're in love with something, you will convey it. You'll get your message across. And that chap's ability has appeared to everyone. Now, I had a young fellow in a meeting like that. I watched him for years. And he only grew as a little fellow, and I watched him. Every time he came to the meeting, he'd come with his Bible open, and you'd watch him, and the kids would all get around him. And you know, I had to be very careful because he was related to me, so I felt a bit inhibited by that. But anyway, I suggested to the AB they might try this kid, and at that time we were very conservative, we wouldn't try any young men at all. Till in the end they'd finally found a gap, and somebody else suggested him, and I shut up and I thought, shut your mouth, you know, and see what happens. And that little lad got this exhortation. I immediately invited him over to my place. Now I said, listen, this is your opportunity. Now I said, young men, now I'm telling you this because I'm advising you the same. When you get an opportunity, the last thing in the world you do is stand up there and say, the problem with the ecclesias today is this. It'll go down like a lead balloon coming from a young man that will just fall on the floor like a lead balloon. You do not get up there at your age and say, the trouble with the brotherhood today is this. You don't do that. You pick a positive theme. You speak about prayer or praise or the kingdom or about your attitude towards God, and you speak joyfully, enthusiastically and lovingly about what you're doing. So I got this kid home, got the message, because he was apt to do little things like that. Well, that lad picked a theme in the Psalms, and I was on the edge of my chair. I tell you, it was absolutely magnificent. I was absolutely mesmerized. He took a theme, I can tell you today, it was absolutely magnificent. He took a theme about the nearness of God in a person's life. And he took the figures of the Psalms of how that David, in his imagination, painted this figure of Almighty God, and how God was so close to him. And he was so close at times that David would speak lovingly of him, and other times reverently of him, and almost awestruck of him. And I remember this brother quoting the psalm where God, like a giant, that David was running away from him. This lad's telling me, he clearly was like this, goggle-eyed, and he's going through this psalm, and he says that David ran into the city, like running away from the giant, and the giant come lumbering up to the wall. This is in the language of David. He put his hand over the wall of David's head, and he couldn't get away from him. God was with him. Boy! And I just sat there. It was magnificent. Now that lad, you know something? It was rare in our ecclesia. One exhortation, he got voted on the exhorting list the next year. That was unique in our meeting. Now he wasn't a lad that was asking to speak, but it was obvious he was in love with that Bible. Now let me illustrate my point. We're talking to a bunch of lads, you see, these kids here, and I'm giving them talking about the Bible. I have got a Bible, right? Now you say, how am I going to be a good speaker? And I say, have a look at this, and they're all, wow, Uncle John, that's fantastic. And then, you know, Ben says to me, oh, I don't know how you see that. Oh, I've never seen that. That's absolutely marvellous. I'd never be able to do that. Okay. Then we finally get around, we finish the conversation, and then someone starts talking about motor cars. And all of a sudden, he becomes an encyclopedia. You know, there's six cylinders, and they go, and the spark blows, and he talks to me blind, and he's really animated about this, and he's got, you know, these they take your teeth out or something, and you know, I'm blinded with sight, and it's obvious he's absolutely in love with motor cars, and he's got his message across to me. See my point? And you see, it's what you love, isn't it? It's what you love. And it's amazing how brethren will stand there with their mouth open and, oh, I couldn't do that. Change the subject to what they love. Change it. And they become eloquent, absolutely eloquent. It's about what they love. And I say to my dying day that if you love something and you probably can't even speak the King's English, you will get that across if you love it. And that's the only criteria. This business about, you know, you've got to be sort of technically correct and all this sort of thing is all very well, but you have to love what you're doing. You talk, Lani Boone, about knitting. She don't say very much, but she knows about plain and pearl. You see this point? Because that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, you watch a lady, you know, your sister will stand around with you, and there'd be a group of brethren, and you're talking ecclesial life, and the sister's looking at the clock. Dear, we've got to go home. It's getting late, love. And then another sister comes up and says, hey, love, did you hear about Marie? She had a boy. Did she? What did it weigh? Oh, seven. I said, oh, seven. I'm bound. And then you're standing there saying, dear, we need to go home, love. Yeah, well, wait a minute. Was it a lovely little thing? And what can I... Isn't that why they love babies? Don't they? Isn't that true? It's what you're in love with. It's what you love. And it's an amazing thing. If you fall in love with the Bible, you will get it across. And your profiting will appear to all. Now look at some of the virtues that young Timothy was told in order if he wants to be an effective member of the ecclesia. Look at him. He's got to be an example of the believers in word. Logos. Outward expression of the inward thought. So what he says has got to come from his brain. He's got to be in conversation, behaviour. That is, having your conversation chaste or honest, as Peter says. Now these are attributes which will put you in ecclesial life. He's got to be an example of the believers in love, agape. Not just an impulse of the feelings, but a deliberate assent of the will based upon the intelligent understanding and the love of God and the brethren. He's got to decide to be full of love, not just an impulse, though that is included in it. It's not excluded, but it's got to be a deliberate assent of the will for right reasons. He's got to be an example in spirit, pneuma, a breath, used in the Bible as a mental disposition. For example, you read about the spirit of humility, don't you? You read about the spirit of fear. You read about the spirit of love. So you see, it means a mental disposition. You read about poor in spirit. What about this one? Stephen. Okay? Now, you just turn this up. I love this. Now, this is the sort of attribute you need to have. They couldn't answer Stephen. Why couldn't they? You look at it. So Stephen, it says in verse 8, full of faith and power, did great wonders and miracles among the people. Acts chapter 6 and verse 8. Stephen, full of faith and power, did great wonders and miracles among the people. Then there arose certain of the synagogue, which is called the synagogue of the Libertines, and the Cyrenians, Alexandrians, and them of Cilicia and of Asia. Now, did you notice? What's odd about that verse, about all those people from those synagogues? They are Jews. They're all over the place except where? Exactly. You know why that is? Because in the days when that was written, there was the Jews, the Hellenized Jews, the Jews who were, they say, had the Greek influence upon them, that were scattered abroad in all those places, and there was the Judean Jews. And it was common knowledge, and you read this in profane history and in Jewish annals, it was common knowledge that the Jews in Jerusalem were very much steeped in traditions, in ordinances, in carnal washings and things of the law and things like that, in all the paraphernalia which you saw in that film of the night in the church. Whereas the Jews that were scattered abroad throughout the Roman Empire, because they were scattered abroad and because they were fearful of losing their Jewish faith, were the brilliantly intellectual Jews. The brilliantly intellectual Jews. And this was Stephen's debaters. He didn't have the fuddy-duddies of Jerusalem. He had the keen, sharp intellect of the Grecians, the Jews who lived in the world. And they were not able to resist the wisdom and the spirit by which he spoke. Now, there's a very wonderful thing here that doesn't grow naturally in young men. The reason I know that is because it might be astonishing for you to learn this, that I was a young man once. I wasn't born my present age. You know that? I wasn't born my age I am now. I actually grew up and I was a young man. I didn't have that spirit. If you wanted to oppose me when I was about 25, 30 years of age, I'd say, what are you saying? You know what you're talking about? You know what you're talking about, mate? Wake up yourself. But can you imagine Stephen? He's there and his face shone, it says, didn't it? As if they saw the face of an angel. Do you know why that happened? Ecclesiastes 8, have a look at it. They couldn't resist this. Now, this is what you lads have got to develop. This is what Paul's telling Timothy. And this is a rare attribute. It's got to be developed. Ecclesiastes. Here's the reason his face shone. Ecclesiastes 8, verse 1. Who is as the wise man, and who knoweth the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom maketh his face to shine, and the boldness of his face shall be changed. And they saw his face shine as an angel. Now, you tell you what would have happened. You'd have had these Alexandrian Jews, these Jews from Cilicia, Paul's mob. He came from Cilicia. Was Paul a brilliantly intellectual Jew? He came from Cilicia. See where he was brought up? He's brought up among those Jews who were determined never to lose their Jewish faith, and it was razor sharp. And here they are coming to him. Now listen to me, don't you understand what the law of Moses says? Listen to me, here, there, and everywhere. And you look to this Jesus of Nazareth, this holy place. Look at the Son of Solomon's temple. Through the scripture. They wait for his reply. Thank you, brother. I appreciate that. I don't agree with you. Would you mind just listening for a moment while I point out to you some facts? I don't want to offend you, brother, but really, I think you might have that wrong. I hated that. There's no answer to that. He absolutely disarmed them by the spirit by which he spoke. And you see, that only comes when a person knows they're right, so there's no need to be devious. they're absolutely certain of their ground, and when the person wants to present that in a way that it'll be acceptable, because they have an objective and they want to win that objective. Now Paul said to Timothy, you've got to have that spirit, and the young man's got to have that. Last thing in the world a young man wants to do is lose his block. Now they're the attributes. He's got to have a faith, a conviction, an assurance. You'll never ever be any good telling people what you don't know. Some people believe that it's wonderful humility by admitting from the platform that they don't know. And I have had a young brother do that, and I've been at MIC when it happened, and he was applauded by the critic. They used to have in Adelaide the MIC, and then you had the two appointed critics, you see. The chairman used to appoint them, and then afterwards anybody could have a go. And this brother got up there, and he was an evangelical brother. I love Jesus, cause, you know, Jesus loved me, yes I know, because the Bible told me so. And you see, he was a wonderful chap, and he was always very kindly and spoken, but he had a wonderful humility in that he admitted his ignorance of the Bible. And you see, he got up there and he said, his subject was the day of the Lord. And this is how he opened up. Well, brethren, he said, my subject is the day of the Lord. I don't know much about the day of the Lord. This is from Zechariah 14, verse 1. Matter of fact, he said, I'm not much interested in the prophets. I want every word that drops from the lips of Jesus. But here are a few Christadelphian ideas you can sort out for yourself. Now, I'm telling you the truth. This is actually happening. I'm sitting there, and I know I'm not going to be appointed one of the opening critics because I'm not his friend. And his friend's the chairman. But I'm going to be the first one. I'm going to be number three. And anyway, so he appointed two critics who were of the same mind, and they said, oh, what a wonderful brother. He doesn't get up there and say, well, I know this and I know that. He's humble. Very humble. He gets up there and says, he doesn't know. But he wants every word to drop from the lips of Jesus. So then the next brother got up and he said, oh, what a wonderful brother. Oh, he's a marvelous brother. How humble. And so on. And then, of course, he sat down. Well, about six of us left our seats. I won. I think I beat Max and Murray Lund and Bill Gerd by about a fraction of an inch. And I was so worked up. Just telling you this story because I want to illustrate my point. I was so worked, I didn't comment from there. I did what I did last night. I come out here. And the brother was sitting in front. And I said, brother, you know nothing about the day of the Lord, and that's humility. I said, you want every word that drops from the lips of Jesus? Yes, he said, well, here they come. Get ready. I said, because here they come, and they're going to make an awful splash. If they be not persuaded by Moses and the prophets, they'll never be persuaded by me. And I sat down. But you see what I mean? Now you see, there was humility. He was humble, all right. But you see, who was edified by that? Now fancy going home and say, your parents say, well, how did you go to the class tonight? Wonderful, wonderful class. Oh, was it? Yes. What did the brother talk about? Well, I don't really know. Well, what did he say? Oh, you know, he really admitted he didn't know anything about the Bible. It was absolutely wonderful. Now, I'm not suggesting we've got to be arrogant, but you've got to know something. Dang it. Malachi. Look. Then I'll tell you a story. I'll stop in a minute, Jono, right? I promise. But I'll tell you one more story about this, because I want to illustrate my point by experience. Nothing better than experience that teaches you. I learned all this by experience. See, it says here, in verse chapter 2 of Malachi, and speaking of the priesthood, it says in verse 6, the law of truth was in his mouth, and iniquity was not found in his lips. He walked with me in peace and equity, and did turn many away from iniquity. For the priest's lips should keep knowledge, and they should seek the law at his mouth, for he is the messenger of Yahweh of armies. Wow. The word truth in verse 6 is emeth, means certainty. The law of certainty is in his mouth. Now, people think that people who think they're certain about it are proud, and they're arrogant. Well, I believe in one God. Do you think so? He believed in a Trinity. Yeah. Sam the devil, Sam the Holy Ghost, and Sam of the flesh. Yeah, but I believe it, and I'm going to tell you very confidently, there is one God. Am I proud about that? Isn't that a fact? It's a fact, isn't it? Now, here's the saying, the law of truth, the word means certainty, and it says the priest's lips should keep knowledge, and they should seek the law in his mouth. Now, the Levites, as you know about the Levites, were spread through Israel in how many cities?
48.
From Dan to Beersheba, and from way down in Moab right to Bashan on both sides of the Jordan. Spread through the land in 48 cities for the specific reason that everybody would be living near a Bible student. You ought to be able to go just down the road to a Bible student who didn't go to work but was specifically given the ties to stay home and study the Bible, knock on his door and say, "Brother, I've got a difficulty in the law. It says here about the sin offering and I can't understand it. Well, come in, brother. It means da, 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 da." "Oh, thank you, brother. Fantastic." Now, I'm a young man, 22 years of age. I come into the truth. I'm full of it. It was a blinding light. I was a biking of everything. I won't go into that. But I was biking. And anyway, so I come into the truth. Football was my life, you know, bouncing the ball. And I'd come from the big time and all that sort of thing. Rubbish. Okay. But I left that behind me. Took me 6 years to do it. Finally broke the ties with the world and come into the truth. And I learned about the promises made to Abraham. And it was quoted in Galatians 3. Do you know that? And I learned about that. And everybody told me about that. And I learned that the 2 Samuel 7, the promises to David, were actually quoted in Luke chapter 1, verse 30 to 33. And I learned that from everybody. And I was getting filled with this knowledge. But then I started asking questions about what was the cherubim. And, "Oh, well, brother, you don't want to worry about that. No, look, it's not necessary to know that, brother. You don't be concerned about that." And I mean, well, no, I don't have to know, but I'd like to know about the cherubim. So I go, "Another brother, brother, what's this here? It says in Amos about what's this here?" "Oh, well, look, brother, no, don't worry about that. That's not necessary to know that." And I'm in an ecclesia of 600 odd people. At that time, when I was baptised, I'd come into the truth, learnt the truth and was baptised, and I'd never met Uncle Purse. He was away overseas for 12 months. Now, I want to tell you what happened to me. So in the end, people kept saying, "Well, look at this, Brother Mansfield, when he comes home, he'll answer your questions." "Really?" "Yeah." One of the arranging brethren, who was in his 70s, he used to call me Brother Questioner. That was my nickname to him. He did that quite respectfully, but that's what he used to call me. I drove people mad, but I couldn't get any answers because I'd gone through the promises, I'd gone through the fundamentals, I knew there wasn't any devil and that sort of thing. I thought I did anyway. Found out since there is one. But anyway, I'd gone through all of that, see, and I'm frustrated to the nth degree. I want to know. So the day come when Brother Mansfield's home. Oh, he's going to bring this night in the Adelaide meeting in Halifax Street. Wow, I go on all this meeting. They're on the platform. They've got chairs on the platform. All the aisles are gone. They're in the foyer. The place is jammed. And this little chap, scrubby little fella, gets on the platform, sprouts off about his trip. "I went here and I went there and I did this and did that." I think, "Well, so what?" And but I wanted to know. I could not. My question that was burning in my mind, that was number top of my list, was when Isaiah said his name should be called the Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father. And I couldn't get past that. I wanted to know who this Everlasting Father. How could that apply to Christ? And it really worried me. And no one would be able to tell me. Now, I'll never forget this. So the meeting finished, and in those days, people just used to inundate him, and you'd have kids standing on the chair like this, leaning over the crowd so they could see his Bible. No kidding. And they'd be 30 and 40 deep. I'm not kidding. It was like that. And he'd have his Bible open, and away he'd be going. So me, 22-year-old young fellow, shoulders his way through the meeting, boom, 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 you know, and I get to this little fellow, he looks up at me, and I said, oh, Brother Mansfield, yes, I'm Brother Martin. Are you? Yeah, I've just been baptised, congratulations. And I think, oh, here we go again. I said, look, Brother, I said, can you help me? Because in the middle, when I look back, I must look awful rude, you know. And I said, can you help me? He says, yeah, I can help. What's your problem? I said, well, look, in Isaiah 9 and 6. Yeah, he said, what about it? I said, well, look, it says this about the council. I understand it. How on earth can Christ be called the everlasting Father? And he said, look, it means that, 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 that. Wow! I couldn't believe it. I just backed out of that crowd and I thought, wow. He just took me in a couple of minutes, zoom, like that, through the scripture. He showed me Isaiah 22. He's the Father of eternity. Took me into the New Testament, showed me this, showed me that. I am the children whom God has given me. Bang, bang, bang. Wow. Now, the priest's lips should keep knowledge and they should seek the Lord his mouth. Now, you know what I used to do? I'd burn to the meeting of the Sunday morning, early, park my car and wait for him. Here he comes with Ali Dias, I join the two of them. And Ali Dias said, come on, Purse, come on, Purse, we'll be late, we're in the foyer, come on, Purse. And then I'd wait for him afterwards, down to his car, Uncle Purse, all the way back to his car. I did that for I don't know how long. Till one Sunday morning, this is what happened. Now, this is what I mean about understanding that Bible and what it meant to me. So one Sunday morning, I'm walking into the meeting. Uncle Purse, look, I have a problem with this. He said, well, look, it's here, John. I'm making it. Yeah, okay. And he goes, come on, Purse, but we'll be late. We got in the foyer and he stopped. And she said, come on, Purse. She's a lovely, lovely Aunt Doris, but she was right. You know, the meeting was getting on. Come on, Purse. And he said, what are you doing tomorrow night? I said, nothing. I wouldn't care if I was getting married. I said, I'm doing nothing. He said, give us a ring tomorrow and I'll see what I can do. So I rang him up. And that started a program where I used to go down to his place twice a week. At 5 o'clock after work, I'd turn up, we'd have tea with Auntie Doris and the children. They'd all go off to bed at about 9 or 10 o'clock, and him and I would sit there till the early hours of the morning. I tell you what, you would never know what that meant to me. When I had a brother, I could say, what's that mean? He says, it means that. You've got no idea. Look, I used to land home, and as true as I'm standing here, if you'd have said to me, if you'd have been in my kitchen when I walked in there, when everybody was in bed, it was in darkness, and you'd have said to me which way you'd come home, I would not have a clue. I wouldn't know what road I took and how many turns. I would not. I was just... wow! But you see what I mean? So you want to be something in the truth, you've got to have that. You've got to have knowledge. Now, Luke made the point the other night, and it's a valuable point. Knowledge puffeth up. And it does. It's inevitable. Because if a young fellow knows something, and someone tells him he knows it. And he's going to get a bit proud. It's almost impossible that it's not going to happen. Knowledge, and Paul's not talking about worldly knowledge only. He's talking about biblical knowledge in that context. It will puff up. What you don't do is discourage that young man with his knowledge. You tell him to go on getting knowledge. But he's got to learn to temper that with these virtues. Until in the end, knowledge coupled with these things makes him a valuable member of the ecclesia. But don't let anyone discourage our young men because they got knowledge. Now, I know what happens. I know that when, after the last year, when we left this place, you guys went home on fire, right? Actually, so did only Bern and I. We were on fire too. We loved it. But I know that when you get back, young as you are, you're going to blaze away in the meeting, aren't you? All guns blazing in your meeting. And all of a sudden, people are going to go, what gives in? Now, some people will appreciate that. Others will misunderstand it. And you'll do it the wrong way. If you don't, you wouldn't be human. And you wouldn't be young. It's up to you to be discreet in the way you use your knowledge. And Joe, you're a responsible brother. Andrew, the two Andrews at the back. It's up to the older brethren to gently rebuke the young men, but encourage them to go on studying, isn't it? That's the answer, isn't it? Don't ever discourage knowledge, even if it's used wrongfully. I remember a young fella in our young people meeting was totally obnoxious. He was obnoxious. He'd almost sneer at the kids for their lack of knowledge, you brainless twits. I mean, it was awful. But I tell you something, he had knowledge. He really did. That brother grew to be a wonderful brother. And in a certain crisis in this country, that brother played a profound part in helping out immensely. He learnt. He learnt, but he was obnoxious as a kid. Oh, absolutely terrible. But he learnt, and you've got to learn that. You've got to temper that with the way you behave, the love you show, the spirit in which it is done, but you have to have your conviction. It's got to be strong, and you have to have purity. Now, on that last question, and we'll finish with this, Jono, on this last one, this is where we can all come undone. You can try all of this, and you can have all the knowledge in the world, but this is where we're going to have a struggle, isn't it? That's where we have our problem. That young men have that problem. Cleanness, chastity, you know, keeping your mind straight. And when we have our night together, which we will, have a chat about our problems we have with the world and with everything else that goes on in the world, we'll talk about that. But, you know, boys, you've got to be so careful with that, because you have to strive to have a good moral life. Because when you lose confidence in yourself, I don't mean having self-confidence is good in one way, but in another way it is, in the sense if you lose confidence in yourself, if you get to a point of depression and despondency because you can't control your emotions or your mind, then you're going to be no good to anyone and no good to yourself. There has to be a self-control, without which all the other virtues will go out the window, because you'll just, in the end, you'll just dissolve. So that, you know, you need, therefore, to do these things. Now, I'll just sit down a minute, but is there any questions you want to ask me about ecclesial life or whatever? Mark. Absolutely. Mark, tell me about it, will you? I'll tell you what, you ask the question. Now, look, please understand this, Mark, and all of you, please understand. When I answer a question of this nature, I inevitably tell you about my experience. Now, that's because I want to tell you how what we do. But you know how it is, with all questions, if you can tell people what happened in your own life, it helps others. Now, Mark, when we started Enfield, we were about 20 strong. I would probably be the only speaking brother in the meeting that of any consequence at that stage, right? More than one or two others, but not many. So we had to be an arranging brother. We had to be delivering leaflets. We had to be painting the hall, doing maintenance work, being up at the busy bees. We had to be doing... I did the Bible class every Wednesday night, and so on and so on and so on, right? And raise kids, one after the other. How do you do it? Well, you've got to work it out. You have to say, well, I've got to do it. Now, you may not be, you say, adept at doing things, but then you've got no choice, have you? But in the end, what happens, of course, is that you learn by experience. You learn by practice. You become adept because you have to do it. Now, I'll tell you how we got away with that. And I don't. This is not good advice, but it was, in our case, necessary. There's no other way around it. But I didn't have time to do study at home. I was always on the go. We would always involve somewhere, because it was only a small meeting and we had to be there in everything. We had to be at everything. So Arnie Byrne and I used to take, religiously, as a matter of policy, we'd take 2 weeks holiday a year. And we would go to some remote beach somewhere and we'd hire a little shack. You could do it in those days fairly good. And we'd settle and I'd take a big heap of books with me. And then Auntie Verna would look after children on the beach and knit, and the children would swim and so forth. And they didn't get dirty because the sand was clean. And I would study, so I'd go down, have a swim with the children, come back and do my study at lunchtime, go down, have another swim, come back and have lunch, do a reading or something, put the children back on the beach in the afternoon, study till tea time, then put go down just at sunset and have a late dip in the ocean with the kids, have a bit of a game, come home, have tea, do a reading, put them to bed and study till midnight. And what happened is, but my mind is orientated to the word on day one, and I don't have breaks at work. I don't have things coming into my mind. So I wake up a Bible. I'm already in that. I don't have to orientate. Now, you believe this. I don't care if you disbelieve it. We went to a little beach resort once for 2 weeks. I studied Hebrews, 13 chapters, and marked it up, and led the class at Enfield on that for 5 years. It had to be done that way. 5 years in 2 weeks. But you see, if I didn't do that, I would never have got through. So now, that's not a good way to do it. But what option did I have? So you see, Mark, whatever exigency you're in, whatever circumstance you're in, you may have to take unusual methods, mightn't you? You may have to do things which you might not normally do, but you have to work out what is best and how you're going to achieve that. Sit down and work it out what you're going to do. And as I say, in a lot of these small meetings, brethren are working all the time, aren't they? They're just involved in everything. They just can't get out of it. So that is a problem. But you have to make the most of what you've got. Anybody else? No?
Yeah, David. You were saying that you'd wake up and you'd be like...
Oh, yeah.
Bible. In what ways... you reach a certain point with your spiritual...
Yes. That's right.
Level. And you realise that you can't go any higher...
Oh no, you never feel like that, David. I'm not talking about a spiritual high in that sense. What I'm saying is this. God says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, right? So my mind's going around like that, and God's mind's going around like that, isn't it?
Yeah. What I'm kind of getting at is, if you've been studying, say, you've been doing a lot of study, and you reach a point where it doesn't matter how much you're reading, you're just staying on the same level all the way. You know.
Yeah, but it doesn't happen like that, you see.
Yeah.
But David, let me tell you something. Neither does that change quickly. So you reach a certain level of understanding, right? And you see the plateau on that, don't you?
Yeah.
That's what you're saying. Yeah. You seem to run out on a plateau. But you know what's... Pardon?
How do you get to the next run?
Okay, you wait. You just simply wait. Because what happens is that this year and next year and maybe the year after, you're running on that plateau. Then all of a sudden you find out something that's related to that year and up you go. And hey, I didn't realise that was associated with that or that or that. And then you might be on that plateau for a while and you think, hey, that's related to that and that's related to that. And up you go again. And what you find is that Bible knowledge accelerates. The more you know, the more you get to know. Parable of the pounds. The man that had the 10 pounds and he developed that. Jesus said, give it to the fellow who buried it and the others. He said, give it to the man that hath 10 pounds. They said, Lord, he's got 10 pounds. That's right. So the man who serves the Lord well will increase in what he gets, because the more you know, the more you get to know, because the Bible is related. You're dealing with a related book. You follow what I mean, David? So don't worry about your plateau. You may be on a certain level for a long time. You may think you'll never get above that level, but all of a sudden one day you'll relate something, and that something will lead to a whole lot of relationships, and you'll go up and up and up. It's just a question of patience. Right, thank you, John.